Welcome to the Nui Tech People podcast. My name is James McDonald. I spend my days interviewing some of the most innovative people working in the tech industry and hear some amazing stories. Each fortnight, we release a new episode sharing these conversations. This podcast aims to showcase the tech projects happening right here in Newcastle, provide key resources to help you grow your tech career, and share insights into the future of the Newcastle tech scene. Hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to another episode of Nui Tech People. Today we have Glendon Franklin Brown, technology consultant at Diamond ID. Welcome.
Thanks, James. We're really, really excited to be here and talk about a few things technology related. So thanks for inviting me on the show.
Mate, not a problem. I think one of the key things which get in and tackle today is that cyber element. I know your career is definitely going down that route and has been, and it's a growing element and focus for Newcastle and technology in general. But for those that don't know who you are, can you give us a bit of an overview of who you are, career to date?
Yeah, sure. So originally grew up in New Zealand. I started in IT in probably 94, small town. Probably the best start I could have had because it was in a little computer company and dealing with lots of different organizations, but in that smaller setting. I started as an infrastructure engineer. So I think a lot of people sort of get into technology and go, do I want to do software or hardware? I decided at the time that hardware was the way to go. Keeping in mind that when I started, it was pre-internet. Yeah, we had dial-up modems and things like that, but that wasn't the internet. That was just I think they call them bulletin boards. So I was pre-internet, and so therefore there was no look up Google how to do that. It was, you know, try and, I guess, figure it out yourself, talk to other people. You know, we had other resources as well, but it's a really good time to actually get into the industry. And so I went through that, you know, network admin, sysadmin, those sorts of things. And I kind of fairly quickly realized that although I really enjoyed that sort of stuff, I could see a real opportunity in the management space. And although I really enjoyed working for that little company, I knew that, you know, that wasn't going to last. So I took it upon myself to go and meet the IT manager from the local council. And when I look back at what happened, that was 1998, so it's pre-Y2K. When I look back and I thought, wow, I had really big balls to do what I did. But yeah. I essentially, you know, got a meeting with him and I said, I really want to come work for the council. Gave him my CV and I think he appreciated the boldness of that. I think that, you know, that was his personality. Yeah, and a couple of weeks later, he said, oh, come and have another chat. And you know, one thing led to another. And I spent a couple of years working for the council. And so, you know, at that point, I thought, Auckland's too small for me. I'll go and move to Sydney.
Yeah.
Got a job with Unisys, but got jack of that pretty quickly. It was basically sitting at a desk, cleaning up IT managers' mistakes. And, you know, although it was a good transition piece because it was quite hard to get into work when at that particular time, it was a good opportunity to realize I definitely don't want to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
I spent just over 6 years with them. So, and through that time, went from those four little nursing homes, Uniting Care, New South Wales, ACT at the time decided, no, we need to consolidate. They went from, I think it was 8 regional hubs within New South Wales to 7, I think then maybe down to 6. My hub got swallowed up into another hub. But at the time, the guy that was directing IT at head office saw that, you know, this was probably a little bit too small for me. Said, no, I think you need to come work in head office with us. And I think you need to establish a technology and innovation role within head office. So, and then there was a bit of a change in management and things went. I sort of sat in the top role for a little bit, but thought, no, I'm not really ready for that. They employed another director of IT and his vision was to basically create a shared service, which was logical. And lots of organizations do that. They go, you know, we're running a large company here. Why are we doing things differently around the country? So yeah, I was heavily involved in setting up a shared IT service for the whole of New South Wales and ACT. And my role was infrastructure manager. So still in that infrastructure space. As hobbies go, I was one of those quintessential nerds. Not too bad. I was a handsome nerd. I like to think I was anyway. My wife might say something different.
Yeah.
Keeping in mind that the average age for a ham radio operator was about 65.
Yeah.
So I was well and truly, I think there's one other bloke that was maybe in his 20s, but I was well and truly the youngest. Heavily involved in scouting, which is really hands-on practical. Ham radio electronics was a new thing at high school, but I really, really enjoyed that. Remember sending away for a Dick Smith kit and living in New Zealand and having to wait what seemed like an eternity, 6 or 8 weeks for the kit to come, and doing all those sorts of things to, you know, how does this work and what does this do and that sort of stuff, which is I think really put me in good stead for working life.
Yeah, right. On that point, like, I interview obviously a lot of tech professionals, and I think one of the common themes is that tinkering, right? That building stuff on your own. Some of the guys that are a little bit younger has been, you know, building computers or playing or building some software from scratch or pulling apart something and then and doing it again. It's definitely a common theme for people I've seen have some success in technology, is that tinkerer mindset. It sounds like that was a big part of your youth.
It was. It got me my first job in IT. The guy that I got the job with, it was owned the company, and he said most of the other CVs, when they put down their hobbies, put surfing, hiking, camping, whatever, motorbike riding, whatever. I was the only one that put down, you know, electronics, computers, that sort of stuff. And that wasn't my whole life, because obviously Scouts was very non-technical at the time. But I think that's a key part of it. Depending on what level of technology you want to get into, you might, if you are a tinkerer, you might say, well, I want to get into creating things. For me, I wanted to understand how it works so I could explain it to somebody else. And then if you go to the other end of it, I now have to explain it to business leaders and decision makers, not why technology is so important to them, but I guess how technology can grow their business, because they don't care about technology, just don't care about it. They think they do. So they got a smartphone and I've got this fancy computer and I do Zoom meetings and things like that. It's more about, you know, how can it grow my business? How can it make me more money? You know, all those sorts of things. So
technology is an enabler, right? For a lot of businesses, even if you're not a technology business, technology is an enabler for you to have more success or scale or grow quicker. So I think technology is playing a part in every business, whether you're a tech company or not, right?
Yeah, and not everyone understands that. Like, there are still plenty of business leaders, and by no fault of their own, haven't had that explained to them before in the way that they understand. And I think that's a key part as well of being a sort of a consulting, is you can't, you know, I can't go in front of a director and say, oh, you need an Active Directory and you need to connect this thing up with the WAN and you need to do it, and it's like, you know, whatever.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Or not even that. Yeah, okay, thanks, bye.
Yeah.
So,
mate, there's a couple of points you mentioned before. Obviously having technology and the fact you're a tinker on a CV, getting your first job, I think that's a great story. I think that's something a lot of people can learn from, especially grads. A grad certificate's probably not enough these days for a lot of roles. It's a certificate plus what else have you done? Have you built something on the side? Or played with? So you show you've got a genuine interest in that. So I think that's a really good lesson for definitely young tech professionals.
Yeah.
But the part I found really, I guess, interesting right there is you actually taking the proactive approach to approach counsel for your for that role. You mentioned, you know, it's a sign of confidence or a sign of, you know, having the confidence to actually go and do that. For people that might not be as bold, might not be as confident, any advice you would provide others to approach a company that they may be interested in working for?
Yep. You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking, well, you know, obviously young professionals in whatever vocation they choose need to be too careful. They're not trying to shoehorn themselves into a role that they would like to have, but really they're not suited for. And if you're shoehorning yourself into an IT management strategy role, but you're not very good at the charisma and the communication things, it's about understanding, you know, where your strengths and weaknesses are. So if you go for a software engineering role, probably the person that's interviewing you will also be a software engineer or have a good understanding of that. So you can just talk shop. And I listen to the guys that interview engineers at Diamond, and they say, yeah, that guy knew what he was talking about. Like, He may not have the best personality in the world, but he is the right candidate because he knows exactly what he's talking about. And when he's got a really tricky problem to solve, he'll fix it. And then I'll tell the customer how he fixed it, you know, that sort of stuff. So my advice to young professionals nowadays is really try and understand where you sit. Don't worry too much about the money or the prestige or what have you, unless that's where you sit, but really understand what your strengths and weaknesses are and sort of play to those strengths.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I don't disagree. I think the part you mentioned there is a bit of self-awareness, right?
Yep.
Understanding sort of where you sit, having a little bit of self-awareness, which is not, it's definitely a learned skill.
Mm.
And then the other part is probably understanding your audience, right? Understanding who you're talking to, who you're going to try to pitch yourself to.
Yep.
But another point you made mention of was, and you mentioned a role, you maybe skipped over a little, one of the roles that wasn't a great role. But I think most people that have had success in their career have had a role that wasn't perfect for them at some point in time. Mm. But you can still take learnings from that, as well as you can take learnings from any successful role.
Yep.
Any thoughts on, you know, learning from bad experiences or learning from environments that maybe weren't ideal for you?
Yeah, one comes to mind, but I won't sort of go into it too much. It was in Newcastle. I guess the signs were there, but the type of person that I am, I'm not going to just quit and leave. I always try and look on the bright side and see the opportunity and so forth. And so I don't regret sticking around for as long as I did, because as you rightly said, I've learned something from that. I'll know those signs next time, and I'll know how to avoid those mistakes in the past. And that's probably what it is. So, you know, I was really surprised when you'd hear someone, they'd start a job and they'd get up at lunchtime and never come back. And I thought, do people really do that? And it really puzzled me. And I understand people make different decisions at different times. You know, I'm not going to waste my time here because I don't like the boss or I don't like the people I'm working with. But I think you got to give things a red hot go and do your best to change the environment as best you can, but learn from the experience. If you have the confidence, perhaps challenge the regime in an appropriate way, but learn from the experience. So the role that I was sort of alluding to from in Newcastle, I thought I was doing the right thing. I was trying everything, and I was getting really good feedback from everyone else except for my boss, and that was my mistake. In that role, the only person that probably should have mattered was my boss, and therefore I should have been making every effort to, you know, communicate with my boss, or I was taking feedback from other people. You're doing a great job. Thanks for helping. Da, 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 that sort of stuff. So yeah, it goes back to that audience thing. What's your audience, and who are you? Not so much who are you playing to, but you know, who do you need to influence?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's important in technology, as you said, like, who do you need to influence? Where does technology sit within the business?
Yeah.
What is its role? So I agree. Maybe one of the last point before we'll dig into this cyber angle in a sec, but one of the other points you made mention of was you carved out the more of the help desk part of your role in one of your previous roles to have that focus. Hey, I think there's definitely some roles out there where you've got to be a bit of a generalist and you've got to take on, you know, a lot. But as organizations continue to grow, you start to get more specialization. That specialization helps people's careers grow. As I said, you made mention of carving that sort of help desk lower end out to allow you to succeed and focus in that higher area. Has that been your experience throughout your career? Is it trying to get that more focused approach?
Yeah, we all try and do that. I always use the example. I empathize with a lot of IT managers. Because that's why strategy often gets left to the last and often never gets done, because they are so focused on keeping the lights going and keeping things running and keeping people happy and things like that. They never get an opportunity to focus on that. So whilst I made a decision not to sit at a desk and be on a service desk, that didn't mean I didn't want to help people. And even though I'm the IT manager of a company and I've got, you know, 11 other people working for me, I was never too proud to go and help someone with a printing problem, even though my boss probably felt that's not what you should be doing and you need to delegate. But yeah, just understanding, it's all part of it is really people management and going back to that communication thing. So, or you might get really good at telling people no. and saying, I need you to log a ticket, and then it'll be allocated to somebody else, which is often a challenge for IT professionals as well. So
it's also a skill. The ability to say no.
Yeah, I don't think I have mastered that skill yet, but, you know, it is, it's really important. And it's not about saying no, it's about saying it in a way that people understand. I used this example yesterday when I talked to someone about how to prioritize work tasks. I said, you know, when I'm talking to a potential candidate, I might say, all right, you've got a couple of issues here. So CEO's come screaming down to the service desk and you're there. And he said, I can't print. I've got a board meeting in 5 minutes and I can't print. And then, but also you've just had a call come in to say one of your remote offices has gone down. There's 50 people sitting there twiddling their thumbs. So you have a decision to make, you know. How do I communicate that to the CEO and make sure, and he might not accept that. He might say, no, I need my printing problem fixed. But at least he's made that decision and he's the running the company. Or I might say to them, oh, this is the situation. How would you like me to prioritize this or what have you? So you're still prioritizing, but you're leveraging off, you know, the person that might be running the company or higher. And then I say to the person, okay, so you've got the CEO screaming at you because he's got a printing problem. You've got a 50-person site down, and then your server room, there's smoke coming out of your server room. Well, how do you prioritize that? Well, you start by turning the CEO around and saying, look, there's smoke coming out of the server room. I need to go and address that or find out what the issue is. But knowing how to communicate that so that you show people that you've somewhat got things in control, but you're doing things in the right order, it would have been real easy to run upstairs and help him with his printing problem. Having said that, people listening to this podcast will know if you try and fix a printing problem that you think is going to take 5 minutes, it's probably going to take an hour and a half and you'll end up rebuilding the computer. So there's always that sort of stuff going on as well. But yeah, prioritization of the task is really, really important, especially in that environment.
And then communication, you made mention. Communication's underrated for tech professionals. It's such an important part. It doesn't matter what your role is.
Yeah.
Let's get in the cyber side of things. Sure, mate, you're obviously in a technology consultancy role at the moment.
Yep.
You've got a greater and greater focus for cybersecurity being part of your role at the moment. And what took you down that cyber route?
Where I came into the sort of cybersecurity space is understanding there are a lot of vulnerable people out there, and it's not about telling them what to do in mine. It's about showing them what to do, why they should do it. And by the way, here's some examples of people that haven't done that before. So, you know, you can keep doing what you're doing. You can keep, you know, using the same password for everything, or you can keep incrementing your password. I've got some really good examples of why that's not a good idea, life examples. But at the end of the day, every time you go online, you're running the risk of something adverse happen. Yeah, the risk might be quite small if you're an individual. If you're a company, the risk might be fairly significant. And the challenge with companies, I guess, in managing that risk is the CEO that's got the printing problem. The other thing that he's also got to deal with is the fact that he's giving all his employees, he's trusting all his employees will do the right thing with company data, with corporate data, with client data. And sometimes I don't know where that trust is coming from, because there's no tangible evidence to suggest that maybe they are doing the right thing. So going back to your question, why cybersecurity? It's really about understanding the threat landscape and understanding where the weaknesses are. And I'm of the opinion that technology is doing its best to keep up. And I think it's doing a really good job at keeping up. You know, you look at the, we used to have firewalls. Now we have universal threat management devices that check antivirus before it comes in and check all these other things that, you know, that other systems had to do in the past. And there's millions and millions of dollars in innovation to try and get ahead of criminals, and using artificial intelligence technology and changing the way that viruses are detected and things like that. So you just an enormous amount of effort going into that side of stuff. But our biggest strength in an organization, or our biggest asset, we always say, is our employees. And there's no getting around that. But our biggest weakness, or our biggest risk, is employees as well, because, you know, because of that trust that we think we have that they'll do the right thing. So it's really just looking at that aspect of it. That's, if you look at cybersecurity as a whole, that's the sort of area that I sort of lean into, is that managing the people risk of it and trying to help people understand, you know, why would you do this?
Yeah, well, and I think what you're saying there as well is like the biggest risk is the employees, and it might not even be on purpose, right? It's a lot of the time, it's not they're being malicious by doing something, it's just maybe a lack of awareness or lack of understanding of vulnerabilities they may be creating. Is that where we're at?
Yeah. So as well as, so part of my role at Diamond is to investigate breaches after they've happened. I have experts that do all the technology, you know, the not so much hacking, but they unpack all the evidence for me and I analyze the evidence. And yeah, most of the time, yeah, it's not malicious at all. It's really just a misunderstanding. Sometimes it's laziness.
Speaking of which, I imagine in this space you have a couple of good stories that are maybe some cyber stories or some things that you've seen that I think might find interesting. Yeah. Maybe care to share any of those with us?
Absolutely. My boss, Rob Buck, who is the managing director of Diamond, he coined a phrase, ethically terrifying people. So when I talk about cybersecurity, I try and ethically terrify you into realizing that, you know, maybe you need to change some of the ways that you're managing your own data. And often it's, you know, people go, oh, corporate data, yep, that's his responsibility. He gets the big bucks to manage that risk. You know, there's some contention there, and I don't necessarily agree with that opinion. But when it's my data, oh, wow, yeah, no, that's top priority for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, one of the examples I use in when I'm training people up on this is I had a situation. I didn't do the full investigation, but I reviewed the notes after it. And it happened to a person in Newcastle, and they were very influential, extremely intelligent person. Cannot underestimate how intelligent this person is. But basically what happened is one day this person got up and checked their banking details, and pretty much there was nothing left in their bank accounts. That'd all been siphoned out. Jumped on their phone, tried to call someone. Phone doesn't work. And so you think about, and if I can encourage people to think about that situation, you've woken up, you've checked your bank accounts, there's nothing in there, and your phone doesn't work. You know, I'm feeling anxious just telling the story right now. And they'd got enough information to be able to fill out a form, a Telstra form, and get her number ported to another SIM card. And so you think, oh, well, how did her bank account details get compromised? Well, most of you will realize that, you know, nowadays, security being what it is, when you try and do anything in your bank that's out of the ordinary, like you try and set up another payee, get a SMS code on your phone, you put that code in, and away you go. And you say, well, how did they get her banking details to be able to log in? And when we went back and looked at what had happened, there were small discrepancies in the way that person was managing their personal information. So name is a piece of personal information, date of birth is a piece of personal information, address, phone number, all those sorts of things. Now, individually, they might not seem important, but this hacker had collected a really solid profile on this person, so much so that they could get their number ported without any question. They followed the Telstra process to the T, and they were able to access banking details. And so it might have taken a few months for this to happen, but this person was targeted, and they were able to get in and certainly upset their life.
Yeah.
But also really teach everyone that heard about the story or was able to learn about the story a valuable lesson. And,
yeah.
You know, I always say to people, best thing to do is you have your multi-factor turned on, so you get that code every time you log into a system, and you use unique passwords for everything, which comes to my next story. So people say, oh, I can't have a unique password for everything. I've got 500 accounts, you know. And so that's fine. Neither can I. I can't have a unique password or anything. Oh, you know, actually, no, I can have a unique password. One of the strategies I teach people is, if you really want to be serious about protecting your own personal information, think about implementing a password management system. I use one myself for personally. I encourage companies to use a corporate one as well for a couple of reasons. If in a corporate sense, and lawyers do this a lot, they'll sign up to an online subscription service. Maybe it's a law library or something like that. And there'll be a shared account because they don't want to sign up for multiple services for everyone.
Yeah.
And you give that information to one of your paralegals or one of your junior partners. They go away and start their own company, and maybe they use those credentials to log on to that system that your company's paying for. So in a corporate sense, you're able to share usernames and passwords with people that never actually know what they are. You give them access to that system. They log on as themselves. They use that information as they see fit, and then you kick them out of that system when they leave and they're none the wiser. At a personal sense, it's about understanding, how do I set secure passwords? How do I remember secure passwords? And people always say to me, what happens if LastPass gets hacked? I guarantee you that it's cheaper to hack me than it is to hack LastPass or Dashlane or anything like that. So, think about cybersecurity as a risk profile. How can I get the risk down to as low as possible? So that's one way I do it, by doing that. And which comes to my next example, I did do this investigation, and it centered around Office 365, which is very well utilized nowadays and is going to be well utilized and well developed. But what Office 365 did, as well as it gave us convenience, because we can log on to our systems pretty much from anywhere, you can get into Word and Excel and Teams and that sort of stuff. It also gives hackers the ability to do that as well without us even knowing. And so what the hacker did, the particular people at the time I started the investigation wouldn't tell me how maybe their credentials had been stolen. But anyway, I'll get to that in a second. What the hacker did was they got in and they set up a rule on that person's corporate email account and Outlook that said every message that comes in also goes out again as well. So, and every message that goes out also goes out to this, they set up a rogue Gmail address.
Yeah.
So essentially they were funneling information out to a Gmail address to then analyze and work out where they could get any more information. Now, this was a professional services company, again, in Newcastle, high profile clients, they dealt with a lot of sensitive information, and the targets, there was actually two people, the targets had access to all this information. And so, when I unpacked the data that had been stolen, it was quite scary to think that this driver's licenses, birth certificates, accounting information, legal information about individuals, contracts, that sort of stuff had been stolen and had gone who knows where. Okay, so there's that issue. Are we ever going to be able to get that data back? Probably not. We need to start cleaning up the mess. But they always ask, well, how did it happen? I did a bit of digging and I found that the particular two individuals had appeared on a website called haveibeenpwned.com.
Yeah. Trey Hunt, is it?
Yep, that's it, Australian bloke. And they'd both been sort of identified in a couple of breaches, but the main one that I worked out was the MyFitnessPal breach that happened back in 2018. And so that breach, 144 million unique usernames and passwords were stolen and then turned up on the dark web about a year later for sale.
Yeah.
And so there's two things here. So, well, first of all, people had used their business email address to sign up for a personal thing, which is now I understand why that shouldn't happen, because now I've put my company at risk.
Yeah.
Okay. Second thing was, have I used the same password that I used back in 2018, and therefore does somebody have that? And so, oh no, I have to change my password every 45 to 90 days. Okay, I must be safe. What these people were doing was they were incrementing their password. So my password might be JimmyJohn1 this quarter, next quarter, JimmyJohn2, JimmyJohn3. Funnily enough, hackers are pretty smart and they figure that out, and they run a script that will interrogate, not only change that password to try and work out what the correct one is, they'll run it across multiple platforms. So they'll go Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, all that sort of stuff, and basically come back with a report to say, yeah, this is where this combination has worked. And, without knowing the criminals, I would imagine that's what they did. And they said, bang, we've come up with Office 365 credentials. Cha-ching, this is awesome. and they've gone and done that from a company perspective, all of a sudden now they've got to get on the phone and call hundreds of clients and say, I'm so sorry, but we've let some of your data go. Yeah. And once that data's gone, it's gone. You can't get it back again. So
yeah,
it's really, really important. I've got some other examples, but we
keep shooting, mate. I find cybersecurity examples, especially ones that have happened locally to Newcastle.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think when they think cybersecurity, they think, oh, it only happens to, you know, celebrities being hacked and this and that. But hearing local examples is quite interesting. So, mate, let's shoot one more.
And I need to be clear, because I'm sure there'll be people listening to this podcast that go, that sounds a little bit like me. I need to be clear that, you know, these people use common sense and they're very intelligent and they're definitely not silly people. So, but it's about understanding, that's what I sort of said at the beginning, what you should be doing and why you should be doing it.
Yeah.
I'm the same. Like, don't tell me what I have to do. Tell me why I have to do it. Or give me some examples of why I have to do it. So this was the same method. The person in question, the attacker, had got access to valid credentials. We didn't dig too far into how that had happened. But the way it played out was the hacker came and set up a rule. They came in and for 2 weeks, because we looked at all the logs and we watched them do it, they came in from, their IP address was from South Africa, which we know isn't necessarily where they were from, because there's software tools that are readily available that can make you look like you're from any part of the world. So anyway, the records show they came in from South Africa and they just logged in every day, looked at what was going on in this person's account. And this was a senior partner of another large Newcastle company that had a lot of sensitive discussions with people. And the discussions that he was having with one client was around superannuation. And the discussion got to the point where do you want these funds directed to? At that point, the hacker went, fantastic, set up a rule. Anything from that client went to the RSS subscriptions folder, which if you go and have a look at your Outlook, it's just a folder that no one ever tends to use. I don't use it. I don't know whether you use it, but
we don't use Outlook.
But it's an older sort of thing. So anything that went into that folder probably wasn't going to get found by the user. And they set up an account that looked very similar to the client. The client just happened to be, they weren't using their corporate or their work things, because this was a personal thing, so they were using a Gmail account. And when we looked at the two different addresses, the real one and the fake one, it was pretty, wasn't hard to see it when we knew what we were looking for. It would have been harder if you were just, you're already having a conversation with that person. You're not expecting anything to happen like that. So, it goes without saying that the hacker then pretended to be the person because he knew the types of language that person had used and gave the person 2 bank account details. And there was several tens of thousands of dollars moved into 2 different accounts. That story becomes even more interesting because the same person tried it again 12 months later, but they had a different avenue, same mechanism, but they were trying to do something differently. And that was based on they were trying to send through an invoice. And at that time, internal processes stopped that from happening because their accounting process wouldn't allow this type of invoice to be paid. I issued the report with my, how did it happen? What was it a breach? In that situation, it wasn't a data breach. It wasn't classified as a notifiable data breach because no data, we couldn't prove that any data had been stolen, even though money had been stolen. 12 months later, the same, we think the same person tried it again. And then a few weeks after that, I was advised that they had been caught by the Victoria Police. And so I actually went into the Maitland Police Station and gave a statement, and that's still an ongoing case. So I don't know at this stage whether I have to give evidence on that, but those sorts of things where, they obviously, we did a really good job at pulling it apart, they can also be used to, I guess, bring people to justice as well. But all these stories suggest that cybercrime is a really profitable thing, which I'm sure it is. But, there are consequences. They might take a while, but there are definitely consequences to it as well. So
I completely agree. Mate, where do you see Where do you see cyber, the future of cybersecurity going, or what's the next few years look like for us?
There are definitely technology avenues. I see education being a big thing. We'll always have to educate people in the right things to do. There's a bit of a movement at the moment in the technical world to suggest that passwords are becoming a thing of the past, or that you'll never have to change your password again because there will be other mechanisms. We used to use the word dual factor authentication. Now we say multi-factor because you might have to put your username, password, a code, your fingerprint, you know, multiple things to access because the criminals are getting ahead of the game all the time. So I think educating people is really important. And I'm not talking about educating engineers. I'm talking about educating, just general people. The two most vulnerable groups in our society are kids and the elderly.
Yeah.
And kids because, they're pretty fluent in the technology, but their risk, their ability to manage risk is pretty low in most cases. And to be honest, they don't have much to lose. They're not the one that's managing the mortgage and the bank accounts and things like that. They might have their own bank account, but if they lose $50, then that's fine. Elderly people in most situations that don't understand technology as well or aren't educated in cybersecurity often just want to help. And one of the big ones is the fella from the NBN calling you up and saying your internet's going to be disconnected. I actually played that scenario out to see what they were trying to do. And I felt very special through the whole process. I got put forward to that supervisor and oh, we're going to help you. And the things he was showing me were bollocks, but they just wanted to try and install TeamViewer on my computer to get access to my computer. So, that middle group there, should be a little bit more tech savvy or should be a bit more educated so that we can then educate the other two groups, either our kids or our parents.
Nice. Yeah, I think it's going to become obviously a more and more important part and more and more prevalent in day-to-day. We're getting close to the end, but we'll wrap up with just some, I guess, individual pieces about you, mate. You're obviously quite educated in this space. Is there any podcasts or books that you've come across? Let's start with podcasts. Is there any podcasts you listen to on a frequent basis that you find interesting?
One really good podcast, if anybody is interested in stories about cyber hacks and stuff, and they give end-to-end story about sometimes the people get away with it, sometimes they don't. What are the ramifications of that? Really interesting, called Darknet Diaries.
Yeah.
It's an American podcast. Jackery Sider is the guy that does it. I try not to listen to too many of them because, it can get a bit overwhelming, but that's a really good one.
Yeah, nice.
One that I listen to, especially for productivity and critical thinking. So probably not so much on the cyber, more about that productivity and critical thinking is the Jordan Harbinger Show.
Yeah.
Really practical advice, but he also interviews people in, military positions and critical thinking positions and social media positions and stuff like that. But really well put together podcast. And the one I'm listening to at the moment has nothing to do with cybersecurity or critical thinking. It's called Loose Units. It's about an ex-cop and his son, and they interview the son interviews him.
Yeah.
He was also in forensics. He was also in the fire brigade. He also ran a funeral home, and the stories are pretty cool. So it's a bit more, some of them are fairly serious, but just trying to loosen up all the serious stuff that I listen to. So
nice, man. Is there anyone in particular you follow online or follow for the best information in regard to cyber?
Yep. New South Wales Cybersecurity Innovation Node. They're sort of like I think there's been a few changes, but I think they're in with AustCert as well.
Yeah.
The New South Wales government's taken a really proactive approach on cybersecurity. And as a state, we want to be the best. You look at Victoria and Queensland and they want to be the best in certain areas. New South Wales really pushing ahead in that. And so the Innovation Node is a group of people of which I'm part of trying to come up with some strategies on how we can do that. TAFE, New South Wales TAFE have brought out some short courses people can do as well, which is, sort of takes away from some of the stuff I do with training, but I make the training a lot more interesting. But if you're interested in self-paced training, New South Wales or the TAFE is a really good one.
Yeah.
And when I say short courses, these are 2 or 3 hour online courses about networking and cybersecurity and stuff like that, just little tidbits about that. So if anyone's looking to get into that, it might be a good place to start, especially if you're coming from a plumbing background or a building background or a non-technical background. Going outside of the country, the UK government, I follow them on LinkedIn. They put up some fantastic infographics. Some of the resources that they share are really good. So this is the National Cybersecurity Centre, and it's a UK government initiative. I've got a lot of information from them. And the best people to talk to about cybersecurity is Diamond IT. So can't underestimate that.
Little plug, nice. Mate, let's go to the second last question. If you had an opportunity to sort of teach a younger version of yourself, you know, a key lesson or two, where would you go?
I would suggest, especially now is critical, look into the future. If you're thinking of becoming an infrastructure engineer, maybe have another think about that. With everyone moving to the cloud, the need for infrastructure engineers at a local sense probably going to become a lot less. Unless you want to get in with a cloud provider, which, yeah, go for it. That's cool. That'd be an awesome job to have. But I think it's more around enablement, software development. You know, we've seen how much social media apps and stuff like that have taken off and been successful, but it's around that productivity stuff. Just look back to the Industrial Revolution as an example. I might have been the one, I'm bringing up a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory example, but I might have been the one screwing the lids onto the toothpaste containers, and then they go and buy a machine to screw the lids on. Why not learn how to fix the machines? The machine's going to break down. And then why not learn how to fix all the machines that all the toothpaste factories are doing? So think about it that way. And that's critical. I worked with a lot of IT professionals that have said, I've got my Microsoft certification and I'm working for this company and that sort of stuff. And then all of a sudden the company goes cloud and just like, well, my skills don't fit the organization I'm with. Look 2 years, look 5 years ahead and work out where your skill set needs to be. And there's plenty of information on the internet. Talk to someone like yourself about that. You're probably one of the best people to talk about that because you understand intrinsically, you know, how the industry works and where it's going and that sort of stuff. But don't get caught. Don't fall back into, you know, I can be a plumber for 40 years. It doesn't work like that in technology, unfortunately.
Hey, not wrong. Mate, if people are keen for a little bit more information from you, what's the easiest way for people to get in contact?
Reach out to me on LinkedIn. I try and that's one of my sort of goals as far as my network goes, is to really leverage off LinkedIn as well.
We'll link that up in our show notes.
Yeah, and obviously I'm with Diamond IT, so jump on our website and you can flip me a message that way. But yeah, I'm probably more keen to talk to people about what we've talked about today and really start to get people critically thinking about that, whether they want to use my services. I'm not really that, I'm not too worried about that, but I'm really quite passionate about the whole philosophy of that. Technology is an enabler, but there's risks, like with anything. You know, you hop into your car, I might have a really schmick car, but I choose not to put the seatbelt on. The chances of me getting into a car crash probably pretty low, but the seatbelt in this analogy is just understanding and being educated about cybersecurity and knowing that. So I use the convenience of the car because I can get to the shops quicker, but I got to put the right risk mitigation strategies in there so I don't get caught up if I'm in an accident. So.
Nice, man. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity and it's been good to I like talking, if people haven't figured that out. So it's been good to be able to, and I'll put a plug in here. One of my goals at work is to be a better listener. So it was nice to be able to talk.
Cheers, man. All good, mate. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Tech People. To stay up to date with all our episodes, our show notes, and past episodes, please visit www.newitechpeople.com.au. Thank you.